Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a destination. Part travel show, part current affairs, Native recognizes the fact that food culture is everywhere and takes the opportunity to examine the nuances that help define a place by using the eyes, ears, and taste buds of farmers, chefs, journalists, and the like. This week, I am joined by Renaissance woman, Dorina Allen, founder of Ballymaloe Cooking School in Cork, Ireland, to discuss her home and what she's up to these days. So hi, Dorina. Welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Good.
Welcome back to New York. So what brings you here right now?
Well, this time we've come over to launch the Kerrygold Ballymaloe Literary Festival of Food and Wine in New York. This is the third year, actually. It's going to be from the 15th to the 17th of May, but that was the main raison d'etre for this trip. How exciting is that, to be launching it in New York?
What does it mean, launching it in New York?
Well, basically, we're last year, this Literary Festival of Food and Wine, which, as I said, is in its third year, has been... Because we have our speakers, it's such an incredible lineup from all over the world of sort of elder statesmen and the sort of the best person in all of the different areas. It's caused such a stir that last year we had maybe 18 different nationalities come to it. People from all over the world, from Japan, Australia, America, from the Nordic countries. Reni Redzepi came over from NOMA, etc. So it's really causing a sort of global interest. So we thought it would be and a lot of the media in here in the US were very interested in it. So we thought we'd come to New York and tell people, announce the dates for this coming year, the 15th to the 17th of May, and you know, just...
And celebrate,
absolutely.
Well, let's back up a little bit and tell me a little bit more about what the event is over that time period in May. It's a literary festival.
It's a literary festival. And actually, this came about because I was in Sri Lanka, of all places, and a friend of ours there who owns some beautiful hotels and properties in Sri Lanka, after the tsunami, I thought, well, how are we going to get people back to Galle, which is down in the south of Sri Lanka, which had been very badly affected by the tsunami. And he thought, well, why don't I do a literary festival? Why don't I have the best writers, the best authors, the best novelists in the entire world and get them to come to Galle? And so he picked up the phone and said, would you like to come to Sri Lanka to all kinds of, you know, iconic writers? And they said yes. And so he put Galle back on the map with this literary festival. And so anyway, he came to Ireland to us at Ballymaloe and he said, you guys should do a literary festival here. So when we were thinking about that, we thought, well, if it's going to be at Ballymaloe, which is a country house hotel and cooking school and everything, it ought to be connected, obviously, to food and wine. And so I did the same as he did, really. I've been, of course, in the food business for a very long time now and have had the opportunity to meet the top chefs and cooks and all sorts of amazing inspirational people from all over the world. So I picked up the phone and said, hey, Marta, Jeffrey, would you, whom I know, would you like to come to Ireland for the our you know, literary festival? And Claudia Roden and, you know, Stephanie Alexander and on and on and on.
Fabulous people.
Hey, they all said yes. So that was it. So it continues. So in the same vein.
Well, like you said, it's going extremely well. But was there a point at the beginning when you were like, oh my God, what are we doing? Is this going to work?
Well, exactly, because it's also, it's at Ballymaloe House, which is the inn, as you would call it over there. It's also in the grain store, which is a converted farm building, sort of multi-purpose, not fixed eating area where we do concerts and all those things. And then also it's at the cooking school, which is about 2 miles from the inn at Ballymaloe. And so we have all these different events. But then we, on the first year, we suddenly realized that the word literary was actually putting some people off, because people thought, oh, well, that's not for me, literary, you know, too posh. I'm going to be out of my depth, etc. And then we thought, well, you know, we have to have a fringe. And I know you don't normally have a fringe with a festival until it's already well established and you're kind of bursting at the seams. But we had a great big shed down the yard, which is nearly as big as an airport hangar. So we decided we'd have the fringe element there. And that was like rocking, bobbing, the whole sort of, you know, it was an amazing energy centre of the whole festival. So it meant that then there was something for everybody from 9 to 90 to come to the festival. So that was, and then we also last year we did this incredible drinks theatre to build on the original wine and drink and spirit thing. And that, so we had the first natural wine bar in the whole of the British Isles there. And then, you know, the top you know, distiller in the world, gin distiller is coming this year,
let's talk about some of the programming for
all
this year
of that. So it's just, so in other words, then people look and say, oh my God, you know, we can if we go to this festival, we can meet. And you see, it's interesting, it's a sort of different thing to a lot of other festivals. You know, suddenly you're walking around, it goes on over 2 days, and you're walking around and then you see many of your food heroes just literally walking around from event to event. So it's sort of very casual. And also the speakers themselves just love to come because they all meet.
Yes.
And they're very rarely all in one place at the same time. So this year, actually last year, Alice Waters was supposed to come last year. but in fact, they had a fire, as you know, at Chez Panisse, so she couldn't come. You know, this year as well, Christian Polesi from Relay in Copenhagen, and he's coming, and Sam Clark from Morrow in London, and Allegra McAvady, and then Valley Little from Australia, and, you know, Roger Phillips, whose name may not be familiar to some people. Actually, this is the other thing. We sometimes, some of these names, of course, people recognise, but others then are not necessarily names of people recognise, but we introduce them to our sort of the devotees of the literary festival. And it's just gathered momentum. It, you know, exactly as you said there earlier on, you know, when we did it, it was nail-biting stuff. You know, would people come and all the rest of it? But my goodness, it just took off.
And
it just
working,
went into orbit. And we sort of have plans really to make this the Sundance of you know, literary festivals, if we don't mind.
Well, you're well on your way. And you mentioned all of those excellent hosts, if you will. And now tell me, what are they doing? Are they doing demos? Is it interactive? Are they doing book signings?
It's everything. And I mean, it's not just you know, chefs and cooks, and they're authors, food writers, bloggers,
tasters,
foragers, you know. So they do, some do cooking. I mean, Diana Kennedy was with us last year, and some do cooking class, and then they sit on panels, and so there's all kinds of different combinations of events at it, and then wine tastings as well, and you know, distilling. You know, it's just very hands-on, it's very, very interactive. And you know, it costs a ton of money to put on one of these festivals. So I'd never in my life, you know, approached anybody for sponsorship. But so we needed to have a festival sponsor. So I was thinking, now it's hard enough for us, you know, to find a fit that works really well for us. So I've always, of course, in Ireland, we have, as you probably know, We can grow grass like nowhere else in the world. So we have a lot of our best foods come from our grass, our dairy products, our butter, our meat and our beef and our lamb and all of that. So I have always, right throughout the years and always at Ballymaloe, we've always used butter. We never used margarine or any of those low-fat products. You know, I mean, I trust farmers more than I trust chemists, as the quote goes. So basically, Kerrygold have come on board as our festival sponsors. And as you know, Kerrygold is widely available over here.
Yes.
So that was a really good fit for us, because in all my television programs, my Simply Delicious programs, you know, for 4 decades now, we've been told that fat and butter isn't good for us. I mean, how ridiculous was that? And it took such a long time for them to review the research and to realise that there was not a jot of proper research to base that hypothesis on, that, you know, fat and butter in particular were actually connected to cardiac problems. I mean, it was really disgraceful. So now we know butter's good for us again.
I'm certainly happy that... Yes. Good fat and butter, especially, is having a comeback. So,
well, you see, I used to always, in all my television programs, never use butter. And I would, gosh, it's really come full circle since I used to get, you know, letters from people saying to me, don't you have any sense of responsibility? Don't you realise, you know, that butter is, you know, doing us damage and everything? And I was saying, well, how could a beautiful natural product like that be doing us damage? And of course, in Ireland, we're especially fortunate, really, because our butter is so good still. It's so beautiful. And Irish food doesn't taste the same without Irish butter.
Well, you mentioned how expensive it is to kind of put on these huge productions. Yes. You have a great space. You know, you had the area to hold it.
Yes, in the middle of a farm as well, a 400-acre farm.
Which makes it special, I think, than
other... Beside the sea, down on the... Mm-hmm. It's down on the south coast of Ireland, east of Cork City. Mm-hmm. So you can fly straight into Cork, you know.
I think having that setting, though, is really nice, because sometimes when you go to these other culinary events, you can be in the middle of an urban space.
Yes.
The programming can be magnificent, but but something about being at Ballymaloe, being on the land, that grass
exactly.
you talked about, just having that kind of landscape really adds an extra layer of flavor, if you will, to the experience.
Yes.
And I think that you mentioned, you know, again, the expense, but what I found really stuck out to me when I was researching the event is the ticket prices are extremely generous, anywhere from maybe 16 to 25 euros to go and spend some time with some of the most famous chefs in the world. And
true.
I think that's really excellent, like you said, to have programming from anyone from 9 to 90, and just to make it really accessible.
Exactly. Well, that was really important to us, because we wanted people to be able to come, and not just to come for one event, but to be able to come for, you know, several events. Because things, even if something is 35 or 35 euros, and mind you, the euro is almost on a par with the dollar now, you guys will do really well if you come over to us, because I think it's there's been an 11% drop in the euro or something, so you get really good value. But anyway, but we wanted people to be able to do lots and lots of events and to be able to sit in on. Some things cost very little and others cost a bit more and so on. And literally, we have the top names from all over the world. Sarit and Itamar from Honey & Co, they're coming too. So that'll be wonderful Middle Eastern food. And then, you know, bloggers like David Leibovich and... Yeah. Valley Little.
David Tanis.
David Tanis.
You should Dunlop, one of my favorites.
Yes,
David. I wish I could come.
I so love David's food. And of course, he writes for the New York Times and everything. We've known him for a long time, since he was at Chez Panisse. So David, we're thrilled. Actually, most people we just invite 1 year and so on. But David, we just so love him.
Well,
we
Alice
want him to be with us every year.
Will Alice be able to
make it this year? Alice is coming this year as well. Yes, she couldn't come last year, she just immediately said, I have to have the dates for next year. So she's been over lots of times in the past to Ireland. She loves Ireland and Irish food. And but this time she's coming to participate in the Kerrygold Ballymaloe Literary Festival of Food and Wine.
Well, I know you're certainly excited about the festival, but let's take a moment and just kind of redirect the conversation. I do want to talk about Ireland a bit. I'd be remiss not to touch on that while you're here. And of course, we'll get back to some of the festival before we wrap everything up. But we could do a whole show just talking about Ireland if we had all day. But since we don't, I just want to ask you, if there was one most important thing for people to understand about Irish cuisine, what would that be, in your opinion?
Well, I have to tell you, the first thing is that...
Besides the butter,
is the perception of Irish food, despite my best efforts, that it's sort of, we live on corned beef and cabbage and potatoes, is totally in no way reflects what's happening in Ireland of today. And, you know, the great thing is that at long last, we've woken up to the fact that partly because, you know, of nature, we can produce maybe the best produce in the world. You know, I mean, we are so favoured by nature. We have a huge percentage of fertile soil. Of course, we're an island nation, so we have, you know, miles and miles and miles of coastline with cold seas, so very good seafood. And we have, and then we have a long growing season as well, and we have established markets. So we can produce the most beautiful produce. Now, a lot of our young chefs and everything have travelled all over the world, and of course the penny has dropped that the quality of our produce is so beautiful, and they've come and they've, you know, come to see what's happening in the US, Australia, Japan, and China, India, Mexico, the Nordic countries, and they come back to Ireland to set up restaurants. And boy, is there a lively food scene in Ireland now. And then one of the most interesting and exciting things that's happening on the Irish food scene in the last maybe 20, 25 years has been the emergence of an artisan food sector. So lots of small farms, small food producers passionate about what they're doing. It could be a cheese, or it could be charcuterie, or it could be, you know, preserves or pickles or jams or something. It might be seaweeds and so on, and or it could be foraging. And so all of that's going on. And then we have a fantastic farmhouse cheese industry as well. So that's all there for people to discover when they come. So you have to forget the corned beef, good and all as it is. There's a lot more to it than corned beef and cabbage now. So and that's it, somehow or other, it takes a while sometimes to shake off a sort of image. And then as well in Ireland, our Irish Tourist Board have had some really amazing initiatives. A couple of years ago, we had the gathering where we encouraged people who are living abroad to come back to Ireland to visit and to maybe come back and spend time with their relatives and friends and to have gatherings of their whole entire family. It could be the Murphy or the Moriarty family or whatever. And then last year, they launched the Wild Atlantic Way. And this is a beautiful, right from the tip of Donegal, right down along through Connemara, down through Clare and Kerry and West Cork and so on, down as far as Kinsale. It's the most beautiful wild coastline, and, you know, with rugged landscapes, so beautiful, you can't imagine. In fact, when I go there myself, I think, my God, I've forgotten how beautiful Ireland was. And so this is their cycle routes, their driving routes, a walking place. And then all along the way, there are restaurants, yes, sort of serving the food of that particular area and so on. So that's really something to look up. So it's called the Wild Atlantic Way. And then, of course, Ballymaloe itself is down on the south coast, east of Cork City. So
not that's to be missed on not, that route.
Well, you know, actually, it's not that Ballymaloe is not
directly.
It's not on the Wild Atlantic Way. It's a little bit further over. But then, you mean, there's all of the east coast as well. So Ireland's pretty gorgeous, really.
Is there a best time of year to visit?
Well, you know, obviously the winter is the winter, and it's a little bleaker, but there are less people. But then any time from, you know, March, April, May,
spring,
from St. Patrick's Day and right on into the autumn, you know, that's sort of lovely. And our, you know, sometimes our weather is malign, but it's, you know, basically, it's not. We have a little rain, of course, but it's nothing like as bad as some people think it is. So in those summer months, particularly from the late spring, summer into the autumn, wonderful. And the countryside looks really magical, actually.
Perfect. Mm. Well, let's take a quick break, but stay with us. When we'll come back, we'll be continuing our conversation with Jarena Allen.
Thank you.
are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you are listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I'm talking to Jarena Allen of the Ballymaloe Cooking School in Cork, Ireland. So before we took a break, we were talking about the Ballymaloe Literary Festival. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, you are quite the Renaissance woman. You've been called the Julia Child of Ireland. John Walsh of The Independent called you a gastro saint. If that's not a lot of pressure, perhaps. You're a farmer. You run a world-renowned cooking school. You launch events. You have television shows. You have several books. I think we were counting like 14 or 15. Not quite sure. But I want to talk about your most recent book. One of your most recent books, The 30 Years at Ballymaloe, a celebration of world-renowned cooking school with over 100 new recipes. And I think what really stands out for me in that title is the 100 new. Usually when you see something that starts with 30 years, you think you're going to get a best hits album. And, you know, even after all this time, you continue to find a really creative space in cooking. So where do you keep finding inspiration?
Well, for me, this is really important because, you know, we every week we at the cooking school, we test new recipes. And so that could be that I've just been to New York, as I have now, and of course I eat for Ireland when I come any New York or anywhere else, breakfast, lunch and dinner, and so everywhere I go, most places, there might be something that sort of tweaks my fancy and so on. So when I go home, I make notes, and then when I go home, we test lots of recipes, or it might be something you see in a magazine, or it might be something somebody spoke about, or I might go out into the garden in the greenhouses and I might see the most beautiful Jerusalem artichokes as we have at the moment, or what you call over here sunchokes, and lovely little white turnips and maybe herbs, and suddenly I think, oh my God, I could, you know, let's put those together in a combination. And so that's, for me, that's really, really important because you have to keep moving on. You have to, you know, watch what's happening with trends and stuff, but certainly not slavishly follow them, because my food is very simple and I'm not really particularly interested in all the, you know, the molecular gastronomy thing and, you know, changing. I mean, it's very interesting that some of those chefs are absolutely brilliant technicians and so on, but my food is a simpler food. It's taking really beautiful ingredients and cooking it simply and putting it together in lovely combinations that people will sit down and not feel too full after a meal, but know where they are, that the food has come from this place, a taste of this place, and they also know what season they are in. And of course then we use lots of spices, we use chilies, and then we have on the farm, you see, we have an acre of greenhouses, so we can grow enormous variety of crops, lots of heirloom varieties. We can, you know, we had we're doing some Mexican food the other day, so we can grow our own epazote, our own oisanta, you know, and of course lots of different chilies. So you know, sometimes people say to me, well, why are you using lemongrass in this? You know, you talk so much about local food. I say, well, look on the windowsill, you know, it's growing on the windowsill. So, of course, nowadays, you know, with all those, you know, everywhere I go, the other thing I look out for when I'm away is actually seeds, all kinds of different seeds. So we're so fortunate that the cooking school is in the middle of an organic farm. So we grow maybe 80 or 90 different crops. And, you know, we even grow some of our own wheat and some heirloom varieties to grind for bread and so on. Then the students have the opportunity also, because we have 6 or 7 Jersey cows, they can learn how to milk a cow.
It's a little bit more interactive than some cooking schools.
Absolutely. Oh, no, they literally go out to the gardeners in the morning and so on a rota basis. And we have our own hens. The scraps from the cooking in the morning get fed to the hens and come back as eggs a few days later. So the students can literally, they make butter every day. They learn how to make butter. They learn how to make cheese, yogurt, learn how to build a smoker and smoke their own food. In the summer, they can go out in the boat and catch fish and bring it back and fillet it and smoke it themselves.
Well, I want to talk about, because you kind of have some, I love the way in the book there's sectioning. Like you have sections about things that maybe weren't even around or weren't even a thing 30 years ago. You have a section about slow food. You have a section about food allergy, sustainability, and self-sufficiency, which is kind of an ode to DIY.
Yeah.
And I mean, you've really seen a lot. You've been part of this evolution over the past 30 years since Ballymaloe is open. Is there anything that surprises you when you look back that, you know, you were like, wow, we were just, you know, organic wasn't a thing. It was just something we did. And now it's become
exactly. Organic was kind of how we were really up to the things started to change in the in the late 40s and early 50s, which coincided more or less with when I was born, because I was born in 1948. So since then, I think the thing that's made the biggest difference to people's health and everything else has been the cheap food policy. Everybody seems to think that cheap food is our right. And this, that there's no such thing as cheap food. It's a myth, basically. It's far too expensive in health terms and socioeconomic terms. And, you know, as taxpayers, what are we like kidding ourselves? We're paying for that food five times over. We're paying for it as taxpayers to provide the subsidies to back up what is now obviously a totally unsustainable system. We're also paying for it to clean up the environment. We're paying for it to fund the health service. And in many of our countries, not just here in America, but it's going to be impossible to fund the health service before long. So we're really going down a very seriously wrong track. And, you know, so, I mean, you know, I remember the first time I came to America, not a little less than 30 years ago, I remember it was the first time I ever heard of anybody talking about, oh, I can't do dairy, I can't do whatever. And I thought, I went home and I told people, anybody who listened to me, they're all neurotic over there. They think there are some foods they think they can't eat. Well, now, I mean, there's virtually nobody, even in Ireland, who doesn't know somebody who is either an intolerance or a thing. Well, look what's going on. This is because of what we're doing to food. I mean, the processing of food, as Michael Pollan says, edible food-like substances, you know. So it's a very dangerous time in history. We have to have a complete rethink about what we're doing in agriculture and for the health of the nation. I mean, the wealth of a nation depends on the health of a nation. And as sure as hell, the health of a nation depends on what people eat. So I'm just, my next book, which I should be writing at the moment, but haven't properly started yet, is Grow and Cook. I mean, that's just a basic title. And that is saying, for God's sake, forget about all of those old diets. Just grow something and get back into the kitchen and cook it yourself.
Is that the next kind of wave of this food movement? Because we know we've really come a long way, I think, in getting people to pay a little bit more attention to eating well, to more sustainability, to more organic. Yeah. I mean, it's all happening as we're speaking. However, is the next part going beyond just eating well into actually growing and doing?
Well, I am fascinated by what's happening over here. Here in America, I think there's an actual grassroots movement, which is sort of not underground, but just barely overground, where people are forgetting about the government, they're forgetting about everybody, and they're saying, we're going to just do it ourselves. So all sorts of people, I mean, here we are in Brooklyn, for goodness sake, which is the epicenter of so much, but so many young people and others they're now connect. They know there's something desperately wrong. They're connecting the food they eat and what it's doing to them with how they feel and their health and so on. And they're saying, look, they're going to take matters into their own hands. They might have a small apartment or something, or they might have a balcony. They mightn't even have, you see, to grow something. All you need is you need soil or what you call dirt. It could be in a box. It could be in a chip basket or something. You need a seed. You need water and you need light. That's it. So you can grow. If you have a window in your apartment, you can grow something. And okay, it could be just some salad leaves, or it could be radishes, or it could be something. But boy, what you grow yourself, you're not going to spray with nasty chemicals and herbicides and pesticides. But every bit of that is going to nourish you. And so even if you grow radishes, you have the radish, you can eat the leaves, you can make soup with it. If you grow beets, you know, you haven't just one vegetable, you have the beets, you have the stalks, which you can chop and cook, and then you have the leaves as well. So, and once you grow something, it's like magic. It's like sowing a seed and watching it grow into something else is a life-changing experience. And then when you take it into the kitchen, you won't want to, you know, you handle it with respect and you want it to taste delicious and you want everybody to know you grew it. And you know that you have something that's going to nourish your family and so on. So I expect, and I hope I'm right, that more and more of that's going to happen. Because and so we must teach our children not just French and Italian and maths and all of that. We must teach them life skills. We must teach them. We've let, in Ireland even, we've let two generations, nearly three generations out of our houses now without teaching them, equipping them with the basic skills to feed themselves. For God's sake, what are we like? You know, the one thing we all do every day is eat. So, but I really am, in some ways I'm very depressed, and in other ways I'm full of hope that people are beginning to realize what's happening and they are taking matters back into their own hands and starting to, I mean, look at what's happening over here with the young farmers, the young agrarians, the greenhorns movement. So everything has to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. It starts as a small little thing, bubbles out, and I believe there's a deep craving in people to reconnect with how their food is produced and where it comes from. And it manifests itself much more over here than even in Ireland, because basically you're further down the road of desperation than we are. I mean, there are many, many areas in this country, even in cities, where there are total food deserts. I don't have to tell you that. That if you're completely, if your only option is a supermarket, I mean, you could starve to death for nourishing food, you know, because you need to be able to get food. You see, freshness is incredibly important. It needs to be fresh, and so that all the nutrients are there intact and so on. And then our food should be our medicine. So then you, every bite you eat is nourishing you and is wholesome and is our medicine. I mean, we also forget that antibiotics are only whatever number of, not even 100 years old. And so before that, in the winter and everything, my great-grandmother, her whole preoccupation would be to feed the family really well so they would resist colds and flu and everything like that. We've totally forgotten that. I mean, you've come back from Asia, but in Asia, they know that your food is your medicine.
Definitely some great takeaways from that trip as far as how the agricultural systems they have there. And yes, the medicinal. I think maybe not enough time to get into that right now. But yes, again, you're extremely passionate about this. What initiatives are you kind of undertaking to promote that more and more? I mean, as far as I know, are you taking up the banner of childhood obesity and like education in schools?
Yes. Well, basically, I head up Slow Food in Ireland, actually. Mm-hmm. And so Slow Food always has a very educational element. Mm-hmm. So we have at our particular Convivia in East Cork, we have we link it with 9 local schools, and actually we have a waiting list, but that's as many as we can have at the moment. And we those schools, they come, we teach them how to grow and how to cook, and each of those schools must have, like in the tradition of Alice Waters, they must have an edible school garden and with a compost heap. And then we send a chicken coop and 2 hens to all of the schools, so the children learn how to look after chickens, or we call them hens, but. And they feed the scraps left over from their lunch to the hens, and then realize they come back as eggs. Then they share the eggs and take them home. And oh my God, you can't imagine the excitement. And then they come up to the cooking school and learn how to sow seeds and how to grow and how to cook. And you can't imagine the excitement. You know, children are just longing to be taught how to cook and how to grow. And we're giving them a gift that is going to, can change the rest of their lives. So basically, in every country, our government, I think, has a moral obligation to embed cooking and growing in our educational system. Every child should be taught how to grow and how to cook. And look, it doesn't matter what the bankers do after that. If you can grow some food and you can cook some food yourself, you're almost independent. And then if you can keep a few hens, I know you can't do it everywhere, but basically many people live in the country or in suburban areas where they could keep a few hens. Maybe not a cock that would keep the neighbours awake, would wake the neighbours in the morning. But nonetheless, these are really important things. And they're really important things because it's our food that we're talking about.
And maybe easier done than some people might imagine once they start doing it.
Totally. I mean, really, you know, we're coming, I mean, I know now it's going to be in a month or two before the growing season starts, but now is the time to think about what you might grow for in this coming season. It could be just go along to your local seed shop and buy some peas or even some radishes, something. Radishes in the middle of the summer, from seed to being able to eat them, it's about 12 days. So, I mean, that's a fantastic thing to do with children and so on. And I mean, the thing is, when children are, if you can introduce children to really good food when they're little, then that, you know, no problem. You have to lay down good eating habits when they're young, and then it's much easier from there on.
Well, on that note, thinking about the future and thinking about children, I know I just wanted to really quickly, while we wrap everything up, mention a children's event that you have at the Kerrygold Ballymaloe Literary Festival coming up.
Yeah, well, again, we have a whole children's corner, and they learn how to, they are all about growing in seeds and have great fun and games. So that's a great part of the event. So it's a whole family corner and arts and crafts and all of that. And then we have, of course, in the big shed and in the fringe area, we have a huge artisan farmers market and craft beers and all that sort of thing. And then Kerrygold Corner will have cookery demonstrations with some of Ireland's top bloggers there as well. Craft beer, hey, that's and then there's music and dancing, and you can't imagine.
Well, where can
it's
people
such
find
a
out?
Blast. And then you can mingle with all of your food heroes. There they are, the sort of, you know, your cookbook that you are sitting on your shelf in your kitchen. There you are, you find the author standing queuing for a cup of coffee beside you or something like that.
Perfect. Well, where can people find out more if they would like to attend have that experience?
Well, go to the website, litfest.ie, and then there's also a little video on that which gives you some idea of the vibe that's there. So literally people come from all over the world, so it'd be great to see as many of your listeners as possible. Maybe they can link it in with a holiday in Ireland, 15th to the 17th of May 2015.
All right, Dorina, thank you so much for joining me today and stopping by Heritage Radio.
Well, it was a great pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That's all for Native this week. Next week, I'll be sharing an excerpt from a conversation I had with Andy Ricker when we were both in Chiang Mai, Thailand recently. Don't miss it. Right here on Heritage Radio every Thursday at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.